You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up today at 6 on 1A Plus, a look at the politics of abortion in the 2022 midterms, including a vote in one state to put abortion protections in a state constitution. That's today at 6 on 1A Plus. Now, Wisconsin played a role in the Underground Railroad as one of the last states along the path from slavery in the South to freedom in Canada. As part of our Why Wisconsin project, a listener named Karen Wessener asked how much Underground Railroad activity there was here in Wisconsin. She's wondering where enslaved people seeking freedom would shelter in our state, what kind of penalty there was for helping them. It turns out people in Wisconsin defied the fugitive slave law, and there's an authenticated stop on the Underground Railroad in Wisconsin that you can still visit and tour today. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about the Underground Railroad in Wisconsin? Do you know much about our state's history during slavery? Is there a site in your own community you'd like to share with us? That's 800-642-1234 to join the show, 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. Keaton Kloss is the executive director of the Milton House, the Underground Railroad stop in South Central Wisconsin. Keaton, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having me. I'm excited to be here.
And Claiborne Benson is the founding director of the Wisconsin Black Historical Society Museum in Milwaukee. Claiborne, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you very much. It's an honor to do so. Hello, Keaton.
Hi, Claiborne.
Hello.
Now, Claiborne, let's start with our listeners' question. How important was Wisconsin in the Underground Railroad?
I would say it was essential. I think, it was one of the things that encouraged the South or gave them the feeling that they wanted to fight the Civil War. And now we're talking about the Milton House primarily, but there were some other incidents of the Underground Railroad. But I would say from the offset, very few people really know the actual number because it was actually a secret as they made their way through the state of Wisconsin. But in the case of Joshua Glover, when the state of Wisconsin made a decision, or abolitionists and 500 or so folks made a decision that they were going to break him out of jail, it violated Wisconsin's agreement. Wisconsin made an agreement with the federal government in the 1850 agreement, or Great Compromise, as it was called, between Henry Clay and John Calhoun. And each of them represented their prospective portion of Congress to stop expanding to the west. Kansas, Oklahoma, Nebraska, and the North had agreed to obey the United States Constitution passed in 1793, that indeed it would not continue helping runaways make their way to Canada, and they, according to the agreement, would return their enslaved people back to their proper owner or over to the federal government. And Wisconsin did not do that. Wisconsin out in the open. And I won't say to you that Wisconsin's not the only state to do it, because they weren't. But the others snuck and did it at midnight. And when the troops are gone, Wisconsin did it in broad daylight. And it was in every major newspaper in the United States.
Claiborne,
yes.
I want to get more into to Joshua Glover's story in just a bit. But Keaton, you're with the Milton House, the only site we can really go to and tour that was a key stop on the Underground Railroad. Can you tell us a little bit about the story of the Milton House and its role in that era?
Yeah, so we're Milton House is, like you said, the only certified Underground Railroad site in Wisconsin that's still open to the public. So, you know, as Claiborne mentioned, there were certainly other places and people in Wisconsin who are helping on the Underground Railroad, but a lot of those places are now privately owned and not open to the public. And so we were built in 1844 by Joseph Goodrich, who was a Seventh-day Baptist. Seventh-day Baptists in the 1800s, one of their key pillars of their religion was abolition and anti-slavery. And so when he came to the area and founded the town of Milton, he did so on those Seventh-day Baptist beliefs, including the abolition belief. And so he builds the Milton House as a stagecoach inn and then also operates it as an Underground Railroad site. We know of one freedom seeker who came through our site by name, Andrew Pratt. He came from Missouri on his way to freedom. And so kind of like what Claiborne said, we don't know. We know Andrew Pratt came here. We don't know how many others came to the Milton House seeking shelter. And overall in Wisconsin, they figure only a few hundred people used Wisconsin. We were a little far west to be a direct route for a lot of people on the Underground Railroad, but we certainly played a role in assisting people to getting to freedom.
And Claiborne, I know you've devoted a lot of your work to finding these stories and sharing them with the world, sharing individual stories as much as you can. Why is this such an important part of your work?
Well, before I answer that question in terms of my work, all of Wisconsin is what my work as it relates to African American. I wanted to say that the Milton House and up the central corridor, Rockford, Beloit, Milton, and Rock County, up through Waukesha, Burlington, all of those are, and even smaller little villages and farms. Through that corridor is the Underground Railroad. So it's not just in Milton. And then on the far east side, there is Racine, Kenosha. Not a whole bunch about Milwaukee, but going farther north, Sheboygan, even up to Green Bay and Washington Island. Those are the routes the Underground Railroad folks took via stagecoach as they went to the Milton House, but then also on the back of wagons, trains. Those are the routes and the transportation in which they went north. And those two major areas, the Central Corridor and the Lake Corridor, were the primary directions. And there are people even today can cite houses that they were in, but not everybody. I mean, there, if you went to Milton, for example, and I apologize for jumping here, but if you went to Milton and walked down the street where Caroline Qualls raised $11 to be able to go by a stagecoach or wagon to Canada, to a place called Sandwich, Canada, people would say, my house was an Underground Railroad. There's a little hole back there. But in truth, you can't just – they have verified Milton House as being the Underground Railroad locations. But these folks don't have verification, and there's a special thing that has to happen before you can legitimately say that this house is a Underground Railroad. You've got to prove it. It's not just because somebody says it or because they own it. I'm sorry.
That's okay.
I got a little, but that's very significant and important when people, because people everywhere will say my home was an Underground Road. I mean, there are small towns, there are farms where people stayed at, and they're just and there one time, and some of them stayed long periods of time. Mm. In fact, there were African Americans who stayed throughout the winter in certain locations. In the Madison area, Washington Island, and they moved on when the spring came up. So there are many little places in which they stay.
And Keaton, I understand the Milton House, when it was a functioning business, was a busy place, stagecoaches and trains coming through, a lot of people there. Can you talk a little bit about how they maintained the secrecy of their Underground Railroad activity?
Yeah, so we were very busy. We had about 25 stagecoaches coming a day, so that's about one every half hour, and then you have a lot of trains coming once the trains come to Milton. So at first glance, it seems like that's something that would hinder working an Underground Railroad site, but in reality, it actually kind of helped hide the activity of the Underground Railroad. So the cabin that we have still standing on our property that has the tunnel connecting the cabin to the Milton House, we believe that basically the cabin was used kind of like as a supply warehouse area for the operation of the Milton House as a stagecoach. So we think that freedom seekers would have been put on a wagon and put underneath supplies for the hotel. And they'd be brought to that cabin. You'd unload all of those supplies along with the freedom seekers, and they would use the tunnel to move from the cabin to the security of the cellar of the Milton House. And so, when you see, you know, if it was just a regular house and all of a sudden there's a wagon pulling up maybe at an odd time of day or odd, you know, an odd day, you might kind of wonder what's going on over there. But because we had people coming and going and wagons coming and going at all different days and, you know, times, it kind of helped cover that because it wouldn't necessarily raise suspicion to see a wagon kind of just pull up and start unloading stuff. So even though it was kept secret, in a way, the busyness of the Stagecoach Inn actually aided the operation of the Underground Railroad here at the Milton House.
We're talking to Keaton Kloss from the Milton House and Claiborne Benson from the Wisconsin Black Historical Society Museum about the Underground Railroad in Wisconsin, answering a listener's Wisconsin question. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have questions about Wisconsin's role in the Underground Railroad? Did you learn much about it in school? Is there a local site that, at least according to legend, was part of the Underground Railroad, a story maybe passed down in your family? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. We continue our look at the Underground Railroad in Wisconsin, answering a listener question in our Wisconsin project. Claiborne Benson is with us with the Wisconsin Black Historical Society Museum, and Keaton Kloss from the Milton House, a verified site on the Underground Railroad that you can still tour in Wisconsin. You can join in with your questions, your thoughts at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. If you're curious about this, let's bring out a caller now. Pat is with us in Green Bay. Pat, hi.
Greetings and salutations, folks.
What did you want to ask about, Pat?
I have a question for you. Well, you folks have been talking about Washington Island, and my dad was an Islander. My roots go back, related to several of the prominent families up there. And I have never, in all the years that I've been going up there, I've heard anybody ever talk about it. So where, is there any information as to where people went? Because I do know there was one African American when my dad was young up there, but that's all I know about.
Pat, thanks for the call. Claiborne, do you have more information for Pat?
I don't know exactly. Some 30 years ago, I did a survey of all of the historical societies throughout, and there have been writings about then that's something that I need to find, the details of it. But there were silent getaway places all over the state where people endured winter months as they made their trip to Canada in the spring. And so I don't know exactly where up there they were. I wanted to ask a question myself rather put a rhetorical question in the air. If the citizens would ask the question, why did Europeans, many of them, like Mr. Goodrich, knew that he was going to be engaged and involved in the abolitionist activities long before he left Europe. What was their motivation for wanting to participate in Underground Railroad? I mean, they traveled from Europe to Wisconsin with the sole purpose of participating in Underground Railroad and being engaged. As the lady said earlier, Mr. Goodrich was the person that stood out and owned the building, but the support mechanism to make it work came from all of his church members and all of his friends in the surrounding areas. It wasn't something he just did by himself.
Interesting. Thanks for that call, Pat. And Keaton, do we have documents from Mr. Goodrich, the founder of Milton House, or the people he worked with about their motivations, what led them to do this?
Yeah, as I mentioned earlier, their religion was a big driver of it for being a Seventh-day Baptist. Again, you couldn't really be in that religion and not support abolition. Now, obviously, you can support abolition and not actively do anything about it. But Mr. Goodrich definitely did stuff about it. He also founded a college here in Milton in 1844, where he brought a lot of abolitionist professors and deans. Sojourner Truth he brings to speak at the college. So he's definitely active in it. And it is one thing, we are unique among Underground Railroad sites in the country. A lot of Underground Railroad sites were run by one family or maybe one person, and no one else in town knew that it was happening. Because of Joseph, his beliefs in abolition, Seventh-day Baptist belief, and a lot of the people founding the town with him were also of that faith. We do believe that a lot of people in town knew what he was doing and were actively helping him run his Underground Railroad stop, which was not necessarily the norm in other Underground Railroad sites.
Claiborne, I want to bring things back around. Speaking of working in public, you mentioned earlier the story of Joshua.
I know that you want, and just give me a minute. Political reasons, were they took the position because of political reasons. It was a thing called free soilists, meaning the economically southern farmers competed against northern farmers. They didn't necessarily like that, so they took to the Underground Railroad and its activities. So that there are all sorts of reasons why Europeans in Wisconsin were active members and participants in the Underground Railroad. And in many cases, you wouldn't actually see their names on rosters, just as she's saying, but they supported in any way they possibly could. I'm sorry, I will answer your question.
That's okay. Now. Yeah, the story of Joshua Glover, you mentioned this was national news out of Racine. Can you tell us, spell out the story of, Joshua Glover in Racine and a crowd effectively freeing him?
We asked the beginning question was how many and what people, and we know of two of them, Caroline Qualls and Joshua Glover, a woman and a man. Joshua Glover obviously is probably the most important one, but Caroline Qualls, 10 years earlier, gathered a lot of attention. In the case of Joshua Glover, the federal government is making a decision in 1850, the Great Compromise, that the North is not obeying the Fugitive Slave Law. That's a constitutional law. That's not just a municipal or state law. And the state of Wisconsin is one of those people. Everybody agrees to obey it. The North is saying we want the South to stop expanding to the West, and the South is saying we want our runaways to be returned. Well, in 1854, the state of Wisconsin openly violated that agreement of 1850, and it gathered national attention all throughout the entire United States. That Wisconsin, in Milwaukee, 500 people actually broke him out of jail and hid him out and took him. And it made their way into the Burlington, Wisconsin, where he hid out for more than 3 or 4 weeks, and then into Racine, where he was working at, and got on a boat and took him to a place called Sandwich, Canada. That's the national picture, and as I said earlier, other states did it too, but they snuck and did it. They did it when it wasn't popular at nighttime and when the soldiers were gone. Wisconsin wanted to make a statement, and that wasn't clearly an abolitionist statement, that the federal government was not going to tell them what to do. This is something that they wanted to do, Waukesha is a regional capital for all of this traffic. It's Waukesha that controls the ships, controls the conductors. It's Waukesha that played the major role in it. And having said all of that to say, that isn't to say that the white citizens that were active in it necessarily liked black people, because they didn't necessarily like them. This just opposed something that they strongly believe that they should fight for, which is not allowing slavery to go on for the four reasons in which I meant earlier.
And Keaton, as we've talked about, so much of this had to be done in secrecy for obvious reasons. What are some of the things you wish you knew, wish you could find out about what happened in the Milton House during the Underground Railroad era?
Oh man, that's a question I could answer for hours probably. Kind of the normal stuff, you know, we know bits and pieces. We have scraps of paper and some oral histories. So we think we know how they moved freedom seekers to the Milton House and after, but we're not 100% sure. We've just had to kind of go with what people have left us. So I wish someone had really written it down, or I wish someone had taken the time to talk to people. And obviously historians just really did not do that in the years after the Civil War, unfortunately. So I wish we knew if there were others besides Andrew Pratt who came here It is cool with Andrew Pratt that he does stay in Milton for about 4 years after coming here. And then he moves up to Wells, Minnesota, which is another Seventh-day Baptist community. And so we actually can follow him. We see him get married and have kids and become a landowner and a respected citizen up there. And, you know, I wish someone had interviewed him and asked him more questions. I wish we had a picture of him. I still have hope for that. But, you know, just kind of that normal, I guess, normal stuff is I wish we had more of the whys and the hows than what we do.
And Claiborne, we just have a minute left. What is something you wish you could find out from back of those days?
There are some grave sites in that area of African Americans that actually died. But the Milton House becomes very popular and well-known. W.E. Du Bois speaks at Beloit College and stays there. Sojourner Truth, as she mentioned earlier, stays at the Milton House. So the Milton House becomes well-known throughout the entire country for its position, that being Mr. Goodrich, what he fights for throughout the entire country. And I'm talking after the Civil War, but nonetheless, that Milton House and the hotel, it registers in African Americans' mind throughout the country.
We'll leave it there. Thanks to both of our guests. We've been talking to Claiborne Benson, founding director of the Wisconsin Black Historical Society Museum in Milwaukee, and Keaton Kloss, executive director of the Milton House Underground Railroad Stop. They're with us today helping answer a listener question from our Why Wisconsin project about Wisconsin's historical role in the Underground Railroad, helping people find freedom coming from the slave south up to Canada, with Wisconsin, for some people, a stop along the way. If you have a question you'd like us to tackle, you can let us know at wpr.org/whysconsin. That's W-H-Y-Sconsin. Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, it's this week's edition of Food Friday with advice on cooking with the seasons here in the state. And it is a fine season for cooking. That and more tomorrow here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. Coming up, we learn more about Wisconsin's role in the Underground Railroad as part of WPR's Why Wisconsin series. Now on Monday, 46 migrants were found dead in and around a semi-truck in San Antonio, Texas. As of yesterday, the death toll was 53. It's not the first time something like this has happened. There were similar tragedies in 2003 and 2017. Migrants coming into the U.S. from Mexico and Central America face serious danger. They're vulnerable to coercion and often targeted by criminals. The journey from Central America through Mexico to the United States carries risks of extortion, physical and sexual assault, and human trafficking. The Mexican National Human Rights Commission estimates that gangs make about $50 million from migrant kidnappings each year. We're talking now about the risks Central American migrants in particular face when they travel to the U.S. amid a record number of migrants being apprehended at the border. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you want to see happen to address the humanitarian problems at the U.S.-Mexico border? What do you think the role of the U.S. government should be? Do you think there need to be changes in immigration law, in immigration enforcement? What questions do you have? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. Sarah McKinnon is a professor of communication arts at UW-Madison with expertise in U.S.-Mexico foreign policy and refugee and immigration issues. Sarah, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
What do we know so far about what happened in this tragedy with these migrants going through San Antonio?
Well, what you reported about this specific incident, I think, is exactly right. What we also know is that journey did not begin at the U.S.-Mexico border. This was a journey that probably began for most in Guatemala and traveled through the route of Mexico to make it to the United States. And the conditions that we learned about in San Antonio are probably much like the conditions that they experienced throughout their journey in Mexico. Most migrants arriving in the United States today through the U.S.'s southern border are making these trips in cargo vans. It's the most popular route, and that means a journey through cargo vans throughout the route of Mexico.
This is a dangerous journey, no question about it. Let's start at the origin. What is going on in especially three Central American countries that's driving people to take this very risky trip?
Yeah, in particular, we have to look at Honduras and Guatemala, and These are contexts that are, there's some similarities. There's definitely really significant rates of violence in both countries. Honduras right now ranks as the world's most dangerous place, the most number of homicides per 100,000 people. In addition to violence that's related to criminal organizations, climate is also a really significant issue. There have been important and really significant climate disasters in the last few years that have impacted significantly people's lives and have made the economic stability, the ability to feed yourself and your family just much more challenging. And along with this, we can also say that the pandemic has not helped economic situation. I think it's really significant to note that prior to the pandemic, the apprehensions at the U.S.-Mexico border had been going down. There were about 300,000 in total for that year. And then in 2021 and 2022, we're seeing record numbers. And so we also have to think about the ways in which the pandemic and global economic stability, how these economic channels that are all integrated really impact people's ability to survive and live in their home countries.
Now, here in the debate in the U.S., some have pointed toward stronger policies, or at least stronger talk from the Trump administration, maybe dissuading people to try to make that that crossing, and pointing toward the change of administration as being an invitation to more people to try to make that journey and come across the border. What do you think of that argument?
I don't really think that bears out necessarily. I think we have to really look at the root causes of migration, and the root causes in these instances are issues of heightened violence, instances of instability, generalized instability in people's lives that just make it impossible to keep on living where one is living. We can certainly look at the Trump administration and some of the policies that were implemented, but when we think about the policy lifespan of this, it's a much longer conversation. In fact, we might think about going back to 1994 as a key year in the way in which U.S. shifted immigration policy to really focus on what's described as prevention through deterrence. So implementing policies that knowingly will make immigration harder, so making it have to happen through really dangerous territory or dangerous modes like cargo vans, but literally quite making it impossible to arrive, so one might apply for asylum, just literally preventing individuals' abilities to claim their human rights.
Talking to Sarah McKinnon from UW-Madison, looking at the U.S.-Mexico border, the dangerous journey from Central American countries through Mexico, then across the U.S. border after this recent tragedy in Texas. You can join in with your thoughts, your solutions, if you have ideas or your questions for our guest at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Sarah, a couple of policies that are in operation now. This Title 42 started in the Trump administration during the pandemic, still going on, as I understand it, that makes it easier for the U.S. government to send would-be migrants back. But also the Remain in Mexico policy, the U.S. Supreme Court gave the go-ahead to the Biden administration to not use that anymore. That ruling just came down today. What to you stands out as the key current factors in our immigration, our enforcement policy at the border?
Yeah, so these two policies were really, in many ways, relying on Mexico as a neighboring country to do the prevention work, to make it impossible for individuals who may have valid claims to asylum to apply for asylum. So Title 42 gave the Border Patrol officials the right to expel migrants from the United States to neighboring countries, and there were agreements. So this involved agreements with other countries to allow for that to happen. That certainly has increased the number of these figures that we're seeing in 2021 and 2022, because it means that more people are repeating. So they're trying to cross again in the hopes that they might make it and not be caught. So that's a part of the inflation here. The Remain in Mexico policy effectively did something really similar. It said you can apply for asylum, but you have to wait in Mexico, literally in Mexico, you have to wait to go through this hearing. And both of these policies were really in violation of doctrine that the United States has signed in relation to refugee protocol, most specifically in relation to the 1967 non-refoulement policy. This policy was implemented so that asylum seekers from all over the world might arrive at or within the U.S. border and really have the ability to make their claim, so to claim asylum and have it be evaluated thoroughly. And so both of these policies made that impossible because asylum seekers could not arrive at or within the borders of the United States to do that work. And so we see just today the Supreme Court saying, yes, Biden, you may go along and get rid of the Remain in Mexico policy. So we'll see what happens in the next few weeks regarding that. I don't exactly know what that ruling then means for the Title 42 policy. We will see. But effectively, this has meant a prevention tactic for folks who might be able to acclaim asylum.
It's Brianna Caller at 800-642-1234. John is with us in Madison. John, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What did you want to bring up?
Well, I was just saying that the immigration problem, of course, has been around a long time, and we have a whole lot of ill will and kind of lack of trust, and therefore we're not able to move rational, changes to the policies ahead. And to me, it seems one of the main reasons is we spend a lot of time discussing the rights of the illegals, and we don't discuss the right of those people who choose to come in the country illegally or even are already living here legally. And so the question of rights and grievances is out of balance, that we constantly talk about only the illegals' rights, and people who are here already and people who are immigrating or have immigrated legally really don't feel that they're being rewarded for playing by the rules. And there's no reason to follow the rules, unfortunately, it seems.
John, thanks a lot for the call. An issue of fairness, I think a lot of people would agree with John, for the people who got in line, I guess, and came in legally, Sarah.
Yeah, and what I would say about that is through the prevention through deterrence policies that really began in 1994, one of the things that was implemented was just to make legal channels harder and harder and less available. So even restricting the ways in which one might legally, you know, gain a visa and apply for asylum, things like family reunification, asylum, these are programs that have been in existence for decades. And in 1994, we really start to see a restriction of who is eligible and a heightening of the tasks, the challenges that it takes to go through those processes. And the other thing I wanted to say in relation to the caller is, I'm a communication scholar, so I think about the ways in which we frame immigration. And I think you're right, like so often immigration is framed as a problem. And, you know, one of the ways we might shift that is to say maybe migration is something that naturally happens. It's a human right, and it's a natural fact of humanity movement around the world.
Thanks for the call, John. We're talking to Sarah McKinnon, professor at UW-Madison with expertise in U.S.-Mexico foreign policy and refugee and immigration issues, talking with us about the dangers that Central American migrants face when they take the journey to the United States. You can join in at 800-642-1234. There is, as we heard, a pandemic-era rule that allows the U.S. to expel migrants from the U.S. That is still in effect. What do you think of that? Should that change now? Are there changes you'd like to see to U.S. immigration policy? Should it be easier to make legal claims of asylum? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. We're picking up our conversation with UW-Madison immigration and refugee expert Sarah McKinnon, looking at the dangers that Central American migrants face in coming to Mexico and then to the U.S. after this tragic death, dozens of people in Texas. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Back to your calls now. Alice is with us in Green Bay. Alice, hi.
Hi. I guess I just wanted to bring up, I don't understand, maybe it's just me, but why are we concerned about people moving from other countries to here? What is, I don't see the problem with that. We move to other countries, so what if they move here?
Alice, thanks a lot for the call. There's been a lot of concern about the issue of migration, immigration. Sarah, what would you say to Alice?
Alice, that's a really good question. And it's since the foundation of U.S. laws, this has been a question that's been, you know, wrapped around. I mean, there's so many arguments that are made about framing this as a problem. Many go to an economic argument, although when we look at the statistics, that really just doesn't bear out in many ways. Many talk about the problem or the fear of changing the demographics of the U.S. citizenry. And so that's another dynamic that comes into play. But I think your question is right on. Why is this a problem? Why is this framed as a problem when it's something that people from all over the world move, right? And so why are we thinking about this as a problem?
Alice, thanks for the call. Tim joins us now in Hollandale. Tim, hi.
Hi. Yeah, I was going to say they need to make it easier. I've got a wife I'm trying to get over here from England, and you know it's a 12-step thing you have to go through, and I'm in 1B of 12 steps, and it's been over a year and a lot of money, and she's college educated and provides a service that we need here, and you know it's ridiculous. It is, I'm to say, quite ridiculous.
Tim, thanks for sharing your experience. Good luck. Sarah, I think people may think it's easier to legally immigrate to the United States than it actually is.
Yeah, Tim's right on. I mean, even when you go through the step-by-step following all of the rules, we're talking about thousands and thousands of dollars. We're talking about a system that really necessitates that you hire a lawyer because it's a very complicated system and most of us are not experts in this legal language. And if you do one little thing wrong, that you know, you're told go back to the beginning and start again. And it's many, many years. Even the most simple cases, like what it sounds like what Tim is describing, family reunification, right? This is a system and a process that takes many years, at least 2 or 3 years. And even when one arrives in the United States on something like a fiancé visa or a visa through through marriage outside of the United States, you're still waiting for your permanent residency card. You're still waiting for your social security number. And so the steps just keep on going. It is not an easy system. And it leaves many people in a state of limbo that then sometimes means one is forced to kind of colloquially what we would say is go into the shadows, do things that might jeopardize one's immigration status.
And I know a lot of my family came over from Ireland and Poland with lots of other people. And as I understand it, there's a long stretch where basically if you didn't have visible sores and said no, if they asked if you were a prostitute, you were in. It used to be a lot easier. Is that about right?
That's right. That's absolutely right. The processes have changed. Really, when we begin to look at immigration regulation, it begins in the United States in the late 1800s. And the first communities that were excluded, were targeted for immigration restriction, were individuals coming from Asia, and specifically women, because the myth, the thought was that Asian women were going to be prostitutes and change the morality of the United States. And so the U.S. page laws, I think, are really significant to look at, to think about what does that mean for our fears about what immigration does to the United States and to the citizenry.
Now, bringing things back to our starting point today, this tragedy in Texas, not the only tragedy that'll happen this year, I'm sure. If there were Are there changes you could see being made to make life safer for people trying to make this journey so we don't have mass deaths like this?
Yeah, I mean, I think step one is to take some of these deterrence policies backwards a few steps and to actually allow people to apply for asylum, to take the 1980 Refugee Act on its face value and to implement some of those procedures to allow people to apply for asylum. So many of the individuals that we are speaking about today who tragically died in this instance, but so many other instances, they are really trying to come to the United States to apply for asylum, which means they've already experienced a lifetime of persecution. And that's not a decision that you make just, you know, off the top of your head. It's a decision that you make because you need to survive. And so that's one. The other thing, this is a long-term thing, but investment in economic development in these countries can go a long way. So often what we're talking about here is a crisis of instability, a food crisis. And so, you know, in this system of this global economy that we live in, these economic systems are integrated. And so that would be another thing. That is something that's happening through aid. There are definitely collaborations between the United States and the Northern Triangle countries of Central America to implement some of these policies, but it takes a long time. So that's something as well. And the other thing is to think about the climate crisis and to think about what that will mean for the international refugee system. We are going to increasingly see instances of individuals across the globe whose homes are swept out, right, from under their feet, swept out from under from the earth itself. And so to really look at the international system and say, what are we going to do with climate refugees as they increasingly become a part of the displaced persons around the world system?
And briefly, I think this would be diplomatically tricky. I've heard people suggest trying to make it possible or easier to apply for asylum from one's home country. So you can start the process without undertaking this very hazardous journey across Mexico.
Yeah, I mean, that's an interesting proposal. I think that's perhaps where we need to be really looking to think about, okay, what are some creative solutions to this globalized system that we live in? And that might indeed be the case. And toward one of the caller's points, towards Tim's point, looking at the methods of migration that we have, of immigration that we have, and thinking not about how to make them harder, but how to make them easier to navigate so that individuals can use these processes, these methods that are available.
Briefly, just in our last half a minute or so, one of our callers referenced the divide in the U.S. over immigration policy. Are you hopeful that people can come together on something that's going to help the situation?
I mean, I believe I always have to remain hopeful, and I'll continue to remain hopeful about that. It is a long-term process that we are in to come to some solutions that might make people's lives more livable.
Sarah, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you.
Sarah McKinnon is a professor of communication arts at UW-Madison with expertise in U.S.-Mexico foreign policy and refugee and immigration issues. She talked to us today about the dangerous journey many Central Americans undertake in their attempts to come to the U.S. and how different elements of U.S. immigration and border policy affect them. Coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show with Kate Archer-Kent, if you're looking for a nice park, you are in luck. Meet the author of the new book, 100 Great American Parks, and you'll have a chance, of course, to share your favorites near and far. If you have a favorite park, whether it's just down the street in your community, a state park you like to visit, you name it, you can get started right now. Email ideas@wpr.org. That's ideas@wpr.org. Speaking of, somebody emailed a picture as requested of the Mississippi River, Lake Pepin, Wisconsin, from this morning. Roberta sent that. Thanks a lot for sharing that, Roberta. It's really cool. I'm just going to look at that the rest of the day. Forget the show. This is Central Time.